For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you all for coming. I think maybe on a cold winter's night, no one really wants to hear about global warming. Or maybe we all should be hearing about global warming. I thought I'd start with a story. As Teigen mentioned, I worked as a botanist actually all over the West, from Alaska up to the Mojave, from Alaska down to the Mojave Desert. But a lot of my work was in Washington State, and especially in eastern Washington, which is, if anyone's ever been there, it's kind of like Idaho, almost high desert shrub steppe, and quite dry. And my field partner and I found several species that had never before been described by science in eastern Washington. And one of them was this plant called Areogonum codium, or Umtanum wild buckwheat. And it's a low-growing, matted plant like you might see high up in the mountains, almost flat to the ground, but actually the individual plants are probably 100 years old or more, with these little beautiful little yellow balls of flowers. And we went through the whole process of publishing it and describing it, and it got onto the endangered species list as a threatened species. There's about 5,000 plants that grow along one little stretch of a ridgeline in eastern Washington near the Columbia River. And that was in 1994. And because of its status, it's been continually monitored and followed and studied in various ways. And since 1994, the environment of eastern Washington has changed significantly. The fire is natural to that environment, but as the summers have become hotter and drier, and with the weeds that are there because of grazing, the frequency of fires has increased dramatically. I knew when we found this plant that it was possible, although hard to imagine, that it might go extinct in my lifetime. 2 years ago, while I was in Washington, there was a massive wildfire in the area where these plants grow, and 85% of the plants were killed by the fire. They grew in a place where normally there wouldn't be enough vegetation to really carry the fire, but now there's all this cheatgrass, which is one of the weeds that can grow in this area, and it just swept through the population and killed most of the plants. Also, because of the change in climate, almost none of the seedlings that these plants produce actually make it past their first year. So we'd go out, we'd count the seedlings, and then they'd all be dead the next year. It seems very likely that I will see this plant go extinct in my lifetime, and all that will be left are the seeds that we've collected that are in seed banks in various places. And as Teigen mentioned, it was my growing understanding of the effect of climate change on the work that I did and on the very rare species that I worked with, when I realized the kind of effort that it took to keep these unique beings alive on the planet, and knowing that these huge forces were bearing down on them in a way that changed the nature of my work fundamentally. And my call to Unitarian Universalist ministry, which was well after becoming a Zen priest and really came from my vows as a Zen priest, is feeling that there is this big storm, not just coming, but here. and that I wanted to bring my practice and my life into an environment where I could be of support and teach practices that could be helpful to those of us who are living and will live through this storm. And so talking to you tonight about this, this is very much what my heart is called to do in many ways on this particular subject. And a lot of what I do as a UU minister is bring practices from Buddhism and teachings from Buddhism to help the people in my congregation who are people who are very, very engaged in justice and activism and environmental activism, to help give them the strength and the resilience to be able to continue in the work that they do. So that's a little background. I very much feel, and in this way, Teigen and I have, this is how we've always connected, I've always felt like Dharma and concern for the world are not separate. To think that this is a internal practice about our own awakening is, to my mind, to miss all the teachings from the time of the Buddha through the great Mahayana teachings to Dogen and beyond, because it's so clear, or even just the teachings that come from your own zazen and practice, that there is no such thing as inside without outside and outside without inside. So to think that we can be focused on our own development and not open to the awakening of the world is to miss something fundamental about the nature of reality itself. I thought I would open with this quote from Joanna Macy, who's one of my strong influences. For those of you who might not know who she is a, considers herself, calls herself a Buddhist eco-philosopher. She's in her 80s now, and she's been doing extraordinary work for 40 years on helping people to face very, very difficult realities, from the possibilities of nuclear war to climate change to what's happening in our civilization. And here's a quote from one of her really, her first book, her earliest book, which was called World as Lover, World as Self. The third turning of Buddhism, I think, will be what Robertson Jeffers called falling in love outward. Our mission is not to escape from our world or to fix things by remote control, but to fall in love with our world. We are made for that because we co-arise with her in a dance where we discover ourselves and lose ourselves over and over. And I think sometimes we may not realize how important our practice is, how important our lives are as practitioners, what we bring to all those we touch and to all the environments that we move in as a result of our Dharma practice. And an important exploration of this, metaphor for this, and not even really a metaphor, example from Thich Nhat Hanh, which I share a lot from the pulpit as well in my UU church, because I think it's such an important thing to understand about why what we are doing here, sitting cross-legged in this little room in the middle of Chicago, why it matters. And he wrote, "When the crowded Vietnamese refugee boats met with storms or pirates, if everyone panicked, all would be lost. But even if even one person on the boat remained calm and centered, it was enough. It showed the way for everyone to survive." And he's written about this a lot. He was in Vietnam during the war. He went into exile with many of the people who had escaped by boat. And this was the truth of things, that if even one person could stay calm, they were more likely to make it to the other shore. And then he goes on to say, I am inviting you to go deeper, to learn and to practice so that you become someone who has a great capacity for being solid, calm, and without fear. Because our society needs people like you who have these qualities. And your children, our children, need people like you. If you're like me, when you're sitting on the cushion, you don't always feel so solid, calm, and without fear. But believe me, this practice of sitting still in the storms of our own life and our own individual suffering is creating in us the capacity to be that person on the boat. Every moment that we sit is building that capacity. Is that Kanon on a boat there? Yes. So there we go. Yeah. So that's a good image there. Earlier in December, I sat Rohatsu Sushin at Upaya Zen Center, which was a great joy for me. It had actually been 20 years since I'd had a chance to sit Rohatsu. There are other Sushins that I sat regularly, but that's, of course, the great one of the year. And it was with Joan Halifax, who is a wonderful, socially engaged Zen teacher, Kaz Tanahashi, who I know has been here on occasion and whose paintings are here on the wall, and also translated Dogen, and Pat Enkyo O'Hara, who's from the Village Zendo in New York and also a socially engaged teacher. And it was very inspiring, and it was on the Four Noble Truths, which are, of course, right there at the very beginning of our practice, in the middle of our practice, and at the end of our practice, all the way through. And I thought this was sort of funny. Bernie Glassman, who passed away in November, the great Zen teacher, sometimes referred to them as the Four Opinions. So, in true clown style. But I wanted to talk about three of them in the context of what is happening in our world right now. Because I think that they can help us understand how to approach this very difficult to face reality of our time. One way to think about the First Noble Truth is you could say what is to be, and to develop the willingness to look at, to directly feel what is really happening. And it's this difficulty in doing that, both individually and societally, that is keeping us from skillful action in relation to what's happening. And so, in a way, everything in our life is like this, but you can really see this at this kind of global level, that to turn and look fully at something that is heartbreaking is it's both the first step and the most difficult. And of course, those of you who know Joanna Macy's work know this is what this is her life's work, to help us learn to turn with courage and a willingness for our heart to break at towards what is. And I think it's really important to remember that whether a person is a climate denier or a climate believer, whether you choose to face it or not, whether you think about it, whether you talk about it or not, it's happening. Just as the truth of suffering is happening, whether or not you choose to engage directly with it. And I know I have found in my life that when I turn towards something that's real, even a really hard thing, actually, it settles me. It brings me back to who I am. There's something about being on the run from something you know is real that unsettles your life. And so, as hard as it can be to do that, to make that turn, it's actually a turn towards greater happiness, not greater suffering. That is the point of the Four Noble Truths. Not that we will drown in suffering, but that there's actually a path. And the second noble truth in relation to this question of how our world is changing is really, it's so relevant, right? It's greed and delusion all over the place. That's what's happening at this huge level. I talked about this earlier with Tygen, and I find this somewhat discouraging. It actually turns out people have looked at carbon footprint of people who are very concerned about climate change all the way to people who don't think that it's happening or it has nothing to do with our actions. And it turns out there's no difference. That is, even people who are tremendously concerned overall in the big picture, not there could be people in this room who are very much have a smaller carbon footprint than others, but in general, there's not a difference. And what that says to me is the forces of greed and delusion are very strong, and a certain humility we need to have in the face of that, in our for ourselves and for our society, knowing that that's the water we're swimming in, and it's hard, and it takes courage to really change your life. And I think this is so important to remember. Everything we do matters. This is the Buddhist teaching of causality, that there is no such thing as an action, no matter how small, that doesn't have consequences. And somehow I feel like even reading progressive news and analysis, there's a sense out there that it's just too late. And that what we do doesn't matter, our individual actions don't matter because the problem is systemic, which of course it is, but that and that it's the climate change is happening, we can't stop it, and all these things actually take the ground under our feet in a way. And take us away from this knowledge that everything we do matters at whatever level we engage with it. And that this working with the second noble truth of the cause of our trouble and our greed and delusion is a job for all of us, for each of us individually. And that we are not irrelevant, and our actions are not irrelevant, and the state of our minds in relation to this are not irrelevant. And for the third noble truth, one of the ways I like to think of it is things are workable. It's not hopeless. Our lives are not hopeless. Our practice is not hopeless. What's happening in the world is not hopeless. There is great possibility, beauty, integrity, power within us and in our world. And one of my favorite books is by Rebecca Solnit, and it's called Paradise Built in Hell, which is about what people do. She's looking, as a historian, looking at these huge disasters that have happened in the world, Mexico City earthquake and 9/11 and Katrina, and the extraordinary and almost spontaneous upwelling of compassion and altruism and the breaking down of the usual barriers between people in these times to create responses that are pure love. And we have a story in our head that when those things happen, it's you know, back to, I don't know, a world of just everybody out for themselves. And that is exactly not what happens. And so we need to remember that, that we are entering a time that has some of those qualities. And in those times, there can be ways that we can love each other that go far beyond our limited and safe ways that we can live as privileged Americans. And we don't know what's going to, we really and truly do not know what's going to happen. And here's another Joanna Macy quote that's kind of about this, especially the second noble truth here. We live in a culture that profits from creating numbness to the destruction. And that's really what, again, she's been teaching for so long. Organisms don't like to feel pain. We readily fall into the many feeling numbing addictions of consumption. Consumption of food, media, clothing, alcohol, drugs, legal and illegal. She doesn't mention the internet. Maybe this was written before that. Anything, in short, that corporate culture tells us will make us happy, cool, or desirable. A cycle of destruction has been created. Consume more to avoid the pain of destruction. The more that is produced, consumed, the greater the destruction. So the more we need to consume to avoid the pain. And how do you break that cycle? By being willing to look at what is happening and our own ways that we're caught, and know that we can work with this. And we can wake up right in the middle of this. Another way that we can work with this is repentance, which is not exactly a sexy 21st century American word. But I was really struck by the, I wasn't at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association meetings this fall, and I'm really, really sorry that I wasn't there, because they produced this, among other things, this extraordinary document. They did a repentance ceremony, and it's quite long in terms of it, and repenting for our involvement with systemic racism, gender issues, misogyny, but also what's happening in our world. So I just thought I'd read a little bit of it to you, just to give you a little taste of it, if you hadn't heard it before. Gathered here today as Zen Buddhist priests and custodians of the Dharma, we pledge to face, acknowledge, understand, and hold the weight of our collective karma so that we may practice and teach with clarity, vulnerability, and honesty. I hope you can hear in that the first noble truth. With heavy hearts, aware of our own complicity, we understand, and this is the part I wanted to read you, that as human beings, we cannot separate the gift of our own existence from the violence being done through short-sightedness, greed, and self-importance to our planet and the many beings with whom we share it. And then it ends with, now as we chant the verses of repentance and renew our vows in the full moon ceremony, we bow in reverence, sorrow, and determination to overcome and heal the forces that cause such pain, for ending suffering within and without is the Dharma's true gateway, the Buddha's true heart. And one of the things that's been very interesting to me, I am a Facebook user, apparently Tigan is not, but is that there's been a lot of controversy on Facebook about this repentance language that was developed at this gathering of priests. And the controversy is from Buddhist priests and teachers who say, essentially, some very prominent people, things like, this is Marxism. And I know, that's kind of my reaction. This is Marxism, and we have no business as Zen people to be talking about these big societal things. This practice is about our own awakening and our own suffering, and we are going astray when we start talking about the larger culture. And our sorrow and repentance for our part in it. And that's been really fascinating for me to see. It makes me realize how scary this is, actually. And that even people who are very deeply steeped in the Dharma are made feel discomfort in really recognizing the degree that we are not separate from this broken world, and that our practice is not separate from that world, and that our bodhisattva vow is to help that world in whatever way we can. Again, some of Joanna Macy's work is, she talks about how we have to do both hospice work and midwifery. So the hospice work is in relation to what is really no longer working in our civilization, to be willing to help others through that time, not unlike my work as a UU minister. And midwifery is recognizing and encouraging the new life that is actually arising, new forms, new ways of being right in the middle of what's falling apart. And this is not easy work. This is bodhisattva work. This is sacred work. Hospice work is sacred work. Midwifery is sacred work. To do them together, that's really, and for this whole world, it's a big project. So Joanna leads people through, you know, very powerful practices to appreciate the beauty of creation and the blessings in our lives, to open to the pain of what is happening. One of her big teachings is that it is that numbness that prevents us from acting, and so the first step is to really feel how it feels in our hearts. What's happening, to experience the dying of so much around us, and then to develop a new vision of how to be in the middle of this. One of the things that I think I don't see as much in her work is ongoing practices that develop our capacity to really do that work, to open to the pain, to recognize our involvement in it, to appreciate beauty. And I think it's really important to be very conscious about what practices could be helpful. I have been speaking quite a bit in different contexts over the last year about three practices that I think are available to anybody, with or without a particular spiritual practice, but that can be tremendously helpful and powerful in hard times, and not just in relation to climate, but hard times that come up in our lives in many ways. One is slowing down. We are caught in the most extraordinary busyness and speed. I sometimes say I think rest is a radical act in this culture now. And in fact, coming here and sitting quietly and looking at the wall is a radical act. Everything in this culture pushes us in the other direction, towards greater and greater and greater speed and distraction and busyness and just the struggle to survive financially, economically, for a lot of us involves this tremendous intensity. And so to find ways of slowing down and resting, I think is part of building capacity for this time. The second, which I think is just hugely powerful, is intentionally taking on practices of gratitude. I was going to read something for you that I found really beautiful. And by gratitude, maybe a better word is appreciation. Gratitude kind of has a, like, you know, appreciate your peas or something like that, you know, that you don't want to eat as a child. So appreciation. And this can really renew our spirits. And I loved this. So Kathleen Dean Moore is another one of my heroes. She was an environmental philosopher at the University of Oregon. And she's a wonderful essayist. And this is her book called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. And it's an anthology, but her own writing is in here. And I read this and I thought I'd share it with you because I thought it was so great. The question is, how can we express our love for the world? No letters to your congregational representatives tonight. No second cup of shade-grown coffee. No web search for rates of ice cap melting or declining numbers of polar bears. Turn off the lights. Go outside. Shut the door behind you. Maybe rain has fallen all evening and the moon, when it emerges between the clouds, glows on the flooded streets and silhouettes leafless maple trees lining the curb. Maybe the tide is low under the docks and warehouses and the air is briny with kelp. Maybe cold air is sinking off the mountain, following the river wall into town, bringing smells of snow and damp pines. Starlings roost in a row on the rim of the supermarket, their wet backs blinking red and yellow as neon lights flash behind them. In the gutter, the same lights redden small pressure waves that build and break against crescents of fallen leaves. Let the reliable rhythms of the moon and the tides reassure you. Let the smells return memories of other seas and times. Let the reflecting light magnify your perception. Let the rhythm of the rushing water flood your spirit. Walk and walk until your heart is full. Then you will remember why you try so hard to protect this beloved world and why you must. My first anthology that I edited was a book of environmental and nature writing called Wild Branch. And we did some traveling around reading from it. And one of the things that people would say about the book when we would read is it's full of essays a little bit like that, writing like that, that's like writing from the deep love of the natural world. Often by people whose work and life is engaged in that way with the natural world, is people would say, you know, it's a lot easier to act out of love than out of fear. And so many environmental books are telling us about the polar bears, about the ice caps. And those things are real. And as I said, we have to be able to turn and face these things. But the most effective, I think, action comes from love. And so how we can connect with the love of our own lives, of what's in our culture, of the natural world, that will support us in these times. And it's going to be there. I mean, even as a person in my congregation who's an agroecologist, and he works with weeds, and it's hard because weeds are changing environments all over the world. And he gave a sermon on a poem that has a line in it, what to make of a diminished thing and how to love this world even as it is diminished. And I think it's really important to realize that we can love the puddles on the sidewalk. We can love the trees in the city. And I think, in a way, everything I've been saying has been circling around the Bodhisattva way, the Bodhisattva vow, and what it means to live a life from that in a time like this. Because this is quite a time that we're living in. And I thought I'd just share a little koan that's from the Blue Cliff Record, Case 14. This is one translation of it. There's many others out there. This is Thomas Cleary. A monk asked Yunmen, "What is the teaching of a lifetime?" Yunmen replied, "An appropriate response." This is one of my favorite koans. You too. And the thing is about an appropriate response is that only your own heart, can know what your appropriate response is. It's not what others say should be your response. It's not guilt. It's the response that arises out of love and your vow to live from an understanding of how you are connected with everything, however that manifests through you in your own unique way. And I also want to just say a little tiny bit about Sangha, because I think that, again, sometimes people can get kind of confused and think that this practice that we're doing is an individual practice, that we sit down individually, somehow separated from the rest of the world, and we turn around and we face the wall and we're all alone. But of course, we're not all alone. We are completely in this together. And if you've felt the difference between trying to sit in your living room and coming here and sitting, you know that there is some indefinable way that we support one another. And I think that community of all kinds is going to matter more, as it does when things get hard. When things when we have some privilege and ease and money and all these things that we can use to live a kind of seemingly private life, it can seem like we can make it on our own. But I think people who live in more traditional communities understand that we can't make it on our own. We need each other. We need to support one another. And when the storm hits, that's when you really know it. I have a little retreat cabin out on the southern Washington coast. And when the big winter storms hit, everybody checks on one another in this little village. And it's in the tsunami zone, and I'm aware that at some point it may get hit with a tsunami. And I know that it's a mix of native people and non-native people, just to maybe 100 people altogether. There probably would be no safer place to be than that little village because everyone will take care of each other in that time. However long it takes the federal government to get to them, they will take care of one another. So, just to kind of recap, and I want to allow some time to also talk together. I think what can help us in the storm, first, is to be able to support each other. That's part of that Sangha piece, to support each other in being willing to feel the reality of where we are. To find practices that stabilize you, that help you be that person on the boat for others and for yourself. To really let the natural world and those you love support your life. Oh, and I did not mention my third important practice that I go around telling people about, which is pay attention to your feet. And this is, there's a funny little story about this. So way back when, in my early days of Zen practice, I went and sat a sesshin at Berkeley Zen Center with Mel Weitzman. And at the sesshin, at one point, there was a kind of public shosan ceremony, question and answer with the teacher. And I was pretty young, and I got up there, and I had this whole question about moods and feelings and how real they felt, and what do I do about that? This is maybe cringe just talking about it, you can probably imagine. And Mel said to me, pay attention to your feet. And I was like, I mean, I didn't say this, but I'm thinking, what kind of answer is that? Pay attention to your feet? What are you talking about? And over the years, I've never had a chance to tell Mel this, and he'd probably be like, I don't remember saying that. But I have discovered the tremendous wisdom in what Mel said to me. That to literally, and I mean this literally, to feel your feet on the ground. And I practice this a lot. And in fact, as Taigen mentioned, I spent time at Standing Rock. I was down on the border recently for a clergy witness. And whenever I'm in situations like that, where there's a lot of fear, where there's a lot of uncertainty, I just feel my feet on the ground. And, you know, our practice is really a body practice. Zen is a bodily practice. And to feel your feet is to connect with the earth, to bring your consciousness down from this that has gotten us into so much trouble, down into the soles of your feet, and to really arrive at where you are at this moment. So, feel what your feet. Feel your feet. And I just want to close with a reading from Paul Hawken, who some of you may know of him through Smith and Hawken. He's also written a lot of pretty wonderful stuff about where we are. And he, I don't know if he still would consider himself a student of Zen, but he was a serious Zen practitioner, lived at Green Gulch. And I read this quote and I thought, I want to share this with you tonight because I think it's so beautiful. And it starts actually with a famous Unitarian. Ralph Waldo Emerson once asked what we would do if the stars only came out once every 1,000 years. No one would sleep that night, of course. The world would create new religions overnight. We would be ecstatic. Delirious, made rapturous by the glory of God. Instead, the stars come out every night and we watch television. This extraordinary time when we are globally aware of each other and the multiple dangers that threaten civilization has never happened. Not in 1,000 years, not in 10,000 years. Each of us is as complex and beautiful as all the stars in the universe. We have done great things and we have gone way off course in terms of honoring creation. You are graduating to the most amazing, stupefying challenge ever bequeathed to any generation. You must have done this as a graduation address. The generations before you failed. They didn't stay up all night. They got distracted and lost sight of the fact that life is a miracle every moment of your existence. Nature beckons you to be on her side. You couldn't ask for a better boss. The most unrealistic person in the world is the cynic, not the dreamer. Hope makes sense only when it doesn't make sense to be hopeful. This is your century. Take it and run as if your life depends on it. I think my question, I mean, this conversation can go anywhere, but my question to you would be, what are your practices for opening to what is happening? What are your practices for developing a capacity for joy in this time? How do you practice as a bodhisattva in this time? Or anything else you'd like to talk about? Well, first of all, I love your practices. I think I'm going to try to really think about that idea of the unceasing faith in others, because it takes a certain, wild willingness to do that. And it reminds me actually of a practice that my longtime teacher, Norman Fisher, really has always emphasized, which is that our job is to see the Buddha in everyone. So that unceasing faith has that quality. So thank you for sharing those. Scale is a funny thing because actually we can't know our effect, right? That was one of the things that the Buddha said. When he was asked, what are the things that you could explain but that are kind of like beyond our capacity to hear? One of them was the workings of karma, the workings of cause and effect. We cannot know what it will mean, how we've touched someone and how they may touch someone else and what that'll mean for the world. And another one of my favorite books is a book called The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, which is a brilliant book. And you realize that you don't know who or what will be a black swan, will be that. And basically, it's based on this idea that, you can say all swans are white. All you need is one black swan, and it's not true anymore. So, and that his contention is this is how history works. It's never the thing that's predicted. Things are constantly appearing that were never never predicted, never imagined, never theorized about even. And I think that's like that with our actions. That, and I know for myself, the way I move through my life is I pay attention to, I use this language, not, I'm non-theistic, but it's the language of call. What am I called to do? And sometimes the call is to meet the person in front of me as completely as I can. And sometimes the call is, I have got to get to the border because I am so horrified about what's happening there. And I'm just going to get myself there and be with others who feel that. Now, those are different scales. But in both cases, it's paying attention to where I am called, because that's the appropriate response, I think. And watch shoulds. I think shoulds are almost always take us away, actually, from our true response, because it's something from outside that you're putting on top of your life. So those are my... But thank you for the practices. Yes, please.
On a related topic, I had a moment yesterday where I was looking at recycling, and I was holding a handful of bottle caps, and I could not figure out if they were recyclable or not. And I spent 20 minutes on the internet, and there's not a straight answer on the internet. And I had a minor crisis about it. And I looked at those bottle caps and I realized, I want to do the ethical thing. What is this compared to ExxonMobil or Shell? And I felt so overwhelmed and deeply, deeply powerless looking at those stupid bottle caps. So I suppose that speaks to the question of scale. I don't know if you have comments on that. How to fight that feeling so terribly small?
I think I would invite you to turn into that feeling. Because I think that feeling of smallness and hopelessness is so close. You're so close to the deep grief for the world. And if that is actually the first step, right? The first noble truth, the first step of recognizing what is, then it's a doorway. And I mean, I go through my whole day like that in some ways. I mean, just watching like the amount of the items that move through my life and are thrown away. Or I drive a biodiesel car, but it turns out it doesn't work very well in Illinois in the wintertime. Last winter, I broke down all over the place constantly. Although I found a source of biodiesel, it gels up at well above the average January temperature around here. So now I'm driving regular diesel. And I wanted to take the train here, but I have to get back, you know, at a certain time tomorrow, so I couldn't take the train. But to recognize that all of those decisions, the fact that there's any consciousness at all around it, is the first step, and that underneath that frustration and hopelessness is that the heart of sadness around the world. So I don't know if that's helpful or not, but that's what I would say. Yes, please.
Thank you. Your beautiful talk, by the way, is really wonderful. And I thought, you know, how many bottle caps did you have in your hand? And I was like 10. And could you hold, while you were holding those bottle caps, could you hold anything else in that hand?
Yeah.
You could.
Yeah. Probably could have.
More than the 10, maybe.
Like, probably could have held 20.
Oh, wow.
Bottle caps.
In holding the bottle caps, I don't know why I hold objects, it's just bottle caps. My hand is incapacitated to do anything else, otherwise they fall.
Yeah.
And also that I had to do, I had an exercise once in the miniature when I tried to draw a biolayer, it was incredible the amount of light that reflected off of it. The componentry of it, the machine of it, the images that were surfaced on it. It was an entire universe, that single biolayer. So it became very, it became enormous. And then I had this sense also of its place in time, that particular bottlehead, never mind multiple examples of it, and the transformation, the metal that that bottlehead consisted of, where it came from, where it was going, it, that metal could never be destroyed. It was always going to be present somewhere in the universe. And so I had a regard for it as a tiny, not as a tiny object, maybe necessarily. I mean, I think it was probably likely that before the metal that that so the hugeness of certain corporate interests actually pale in comparison to the physical reality of the small city.
I love that story.
Over time. That's a fact. And so I cannot find myself minimizing any object, however small, relative to the largest that I can see within the world that's operating at the same time.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Time for maybe one last comment. You know, I think one of the great dangers as people think about environmental change is that as people feel their grief, they, the development of defeatism. So that I can even imagine as environmental change and impinging damage becomes really impossible to deny, the institutions that have reasons to not change, saying, okay, but what are we going to do? And I can see it almost becoming like medieval Japan, where, you know, this idea of, oh, things pass, everything falls apart, it's so very sad, and have it become just a wallowing in an aesthetic sense of, oh, sadness, grief, it's all falling apart. And you can just see in this country, as all sorts of institutions resist the change, it all becomes a matter of, well, there's nothing we can do about it, and it all becomes apocalypse movies, and once the disaster comes, the few of us who remain are going to hang together, sort of thing. And so I just don't, what's hard to imagine is how to develop not just the collective awareness, but the collective awareness to not despair, but to act. And I can only see that as overcoming the inertia and resistance of economic and political institutions and structural aspects of society. And I don't know how we do that, and especially in the time frames that may remain.
Well, and again, you know, Joanna Macy has some really great teachings on this. And, you know, she talks about holding actions, which are like the things we do, like demonstrating or writing to congressmen or, you know, stopping corporate. I mean, there's been some amazing stuff out in the Pacific Northwest of stopping these huge fossil fuel companies from building ports, from, I mean, it's been remarkable, and there have been incredible successes. Those are holding actions. They take a huge amount of effort, but they can work, you know, at, even at a pretty large scale. And then there's the kind of nurturing of the new forms that are right there, coming into being, and taking care of ourselves, of course. So I think that when hopelessness, despair, I think there's a difference between grief and hopelessness, and it's really important to see that in fact our hopelessness is not quite fully willing to feel the grief, I would say. Things could get pretty crazy. I mean, you look at what's happening, like, you know, the rise of all the stuff that's going on around women and sexuality and the incredible backlash against it, right? So this is something we know happens, that when big power structures are coming to their end, they can become highly reactive. And so again, we must be the people on the boat. And we will, you know, the ones who can who can maintain, you know, keep our feet on the ground, feel our feet, and help everybody else around us do that. Because, yeah, it could be a wild ride.
We are having this, you know, hopelessness and despair over these larger things because we're all buying into all these things that help us shore off our own, you know, fear of sickness, old age, and death. And so if we can help people on a global scale to accept our vulnerability and the fact that things break and that we break, there will be less of, to really accept that, there will be less of a market for all these things.
And you know, when I talk with people in my congregation, I'm always amazed at just how close to the surface, like these feelings of apocalypse and other things really are for people, just like right there, and yet no one's really talking about it. So we can help the people around us by actually making a space where it's safe to talk about these things, because I think it's weighing. I noticed that around the immigration thing. I came back from the border and I had a little meeting where people could come and I had people talk about how they were feeling, and every person was feeling so heavy. But I'll bet they hadn't told a soul how they were feeling, you know, in the week before about what was happening on our border. And that we, to make spaces where that can happen, we can really help people around us. Looks like we have time for one more. Yeah.
I just want to say, singing helps.
Oh.
Singing with other people helps. The first and third Friday of every month, we get together at someone's house around the piano and sing. Drink wine.
Aww.
And talk. And it really helps because of exactly what you said, those feelings around the surface. And singing brings your feelings up. Sometimes they're sad songs, and sometimes they're happy songs.
That's beautiful.
Yes, we should think very quickly on that. This is something I learned when I was in theater. I was a practice for adding positivity. A lot of times we bring on a theater production can get very stressful. And so a director I had in college was very, very focused on pushing positivity. Anytime someone would come up with a difficult situation or a complaint, she would say, yay.
I love it. I'm going to use this in my ministry.
It helps her ease and, like, bear the weight of that, and also help the other person to use their stress.
Yay. Okay, I have a quote to close. This is from Kurt Vonnegut. And these were his last public words in 2007. And how should we behave during this apocalypse? We should be unusually kind to one another, certainly. But we should also stop being so serious. Jokes help a lot. And get a dog if you don't already have one. Thank you all very much.
So in the spirit of singing, let's close with our theme song for Fort Wayne.